Hello, I'm Jack.
And I'm Martin.
And we are The Washboard Resonators. Welcome to our podcast, The Washboard Resonators Present. Conversations from behind the red curtain on vintage music and stories from the entertainment industry. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Washboard Resonators Present. And this week we're getting back into the interview with Mark Makin with part two. And this time we're going to get into how he got his hands on a prototype square neck and what that entails. I don't really know what it is, but we find out in the interview. There's more info on the process of how he put his amazing book together and some of the anomalies in the National Factory. He also talks about how he developed the trichome with his friend Alan Timmins and Don Young of National Resophonic. And finally, has a really cool story about when George Harrison just turned up to his house in Nottingham, as you do. So here we go. Hope you enjoy.
So tell us, Mark, about the Resonators and the collections, because how many have you owned?
I've owned probably 60, 70 vintage ones, many more instruments than that. I mean,
of course, yeah.
Electrics and Stellars and, you know, 12 strings and all sorts of things.
At the peak of your mania, how many resonators did you have in the house, do you think?
It's never got beyond about 30, 35 in total at any one time. And then,
oh, that's okay.
40 would be ridiculous.
So I know, you know, you've got 60, 70 old resonators. So just give us a little rundown of some of the ones. Like, what about the one that turned up? Was it one of the very first ever made? Tell us about that one.
I had an office in town when I was working in my early days as a freelance designer. I had a city centre address. And I had a friend called Brian, who was a friend on the telephone more than anywhere else. He sort of, I forget even how the connection happened, but he knew I collected Nationals and what have you. He was a hobbyist guitar collector, and he was very eclectic. He would have anything from sort of Fenders through Gretsches through Nationals through anything that he took a fancy to. He rang me up one day. I was sitting in the office. He said, "I've got a Style 2 square neck tricone you might be interested in." I said, "Oh, well, thanks for thinking of me, Brian, but I've got two already. Don't really need any. What is it?" He said, "Well, it's a very early one." I said, "Yeah, but I said, I've got a 28 and a 29. I said, I don't really need one. And I spent, I don't know how long, attempting to put him off. The end of the conversation was, "Well, anyway, okay, even if you don't want it, never mind. I've got to go through Nottingham in the next day or so. I'll come via your office. I'll drop in for a coffee and you can at least have a look with it. And I'll go on to this business meeting in Newark." So I said, "Fine. Nice to see you, Brian." Anyway, he turns up. I said, "Hello, Brian." He walks in carrying a guitar case. I'm in the kitchen attempting to make a cup of tea. As I come in, he's opening the case. I'm holding two cups in both hands. And as he opens the case, I take one look at this thing. I can feel the cups jingling like this. I can't believe what I was looking at. And in there is a square neck trichome with the seven diamond holes around the edges and the separate strips, all of which is telling me this is one of the first 20 or 30 handmade prototypes made by Vera and John on the bench in early 27, something like that. And all I could think to say was, "Oh, that's nice, Brian." to which I said, "Well, go on, you've twisted my arm, I'll take it." And I think I paid him something like 300 quid for it, something like that.
Did he know what he had?
No, he knew it was an early trichome, but he didn't know it was an early trichome. He didn't know that. And I just had to go home. I couldn't do anything else but sit staring at this thing standing against the wall.
Before they kind of got investment and tooling and a proper like workshop, they were literally like almost like panel beating these things by hand, weren't they? And it's that stage. So by this point, did you know that was the situation with this? Did you know that it was one of those absolutely?
Well, yes. Again, all the information, it grows steadily over the years. We knew prototypes existed, and we knew that they had, the key element was this extra seven diamond holes that had been punched in the body top around the edge. They only ran on those first 20 or 30 instruments, and then they realised it was an unnecessary amount of work, so they cancelled it. So it's even from across the road, you can tell it's a 1927 instrument just by that one detail alone. As we got into it and it evolved over the years, what we did start to realize was that of those 20 or 30, not one of them's the same. They were trying literally everything. They make one, they then modify it for the next one. So 102 looks a particular way. 103 is the same, but they've changed it. They've done something else. They've moved the grills, or they've moved the mesh, or they've done something else. So those very first 20 or 30 are really a book in themselves. The learning curve that the two brothers went through on the bench trying to work out exactly how to do stuff is really fascinating. And over time, of course, I've spent many hours talking with Mark Schoenberger of the California Luthier about some of these works. And some of the things that you learn when you see these different things are such telling little details. For instance, in the sound well where the cones sit, there's normally a screw right in the center of the wood well, which sort of holds, anchors things down basically to the perch pole that goes underneath it. On one or two of them, they actually drilled it partially and then stopped doing it and then moved it about an inch further along so that it would be hidden by a cone. So that when you look through the grill, you couldn't immediately see how they'd made it. And it's just telling little details that they obviously must have sat there and thought, if we move this, you won't actually know what we've done. It's just that little bit of secrecy all the time that the brothers constantly went through, you know. And they just make these people come alive when you notice these little details that are different.
Did you have much to do with any of the DePira family?
I met Ed DePira the year before he died. That would be 77. I met Gabriella DePira. And I met Ron Lazar, who was Gabriella's son. He was the general manager of OMI at the time when I visited the Huntingdon Beach factory in 77. Mm-hmm. Rudy was still alive. I think he died that same year when I visited, but he wasn't in the works at the time. And subsequently, of course, since I've done a lot of work on the book, I've been in communication with John and Margaret, John DePira Jr. And his wife, Margaret, who we met. John did a lot of travelling over here and we spent an evening or so at Michael's house, basically. His daughter, Anne, I periodically speak to on the various websites and things. I did communicate briefly with Ed Junior, Emile Junior. Yep. He was thrilled to bits with the book. I was a bit scared actually, because he was one of the few people that actually occurs in the book that I wrote about. So I was anxious when I spoke to him to realise that I'd got it right, if you know what I mean. It's always a bit difficult talking to somebody that you've just written about in a book. But he was thrilled to bits with it, you know. And what I found interesting was a lot of John, for instance, John Jr., didn't realise a lot of the story himself, which I was quite surprised about. And in fact, he spoke to me about how he was fascinated reading the book to learn that what he called the electric DePiras were doing. And what he meant by that was that his family, which was John DePira, Rudy DePira, they were the California, Oregon-based part of the family, who were the acoustic DePiras, I think he would understand them as. And he never understood what his city-dwelling brothers, like Robert and Louis, were doing in Chicago with this Valco company. And for most of his life, he didn't really realize what that part of the company were making. So until my book came out, they really didn't know about Supros and all that sort of stuff, which I found quite surprising me how separate they actually were, you know.
It's such an interesting timeline that you're describing, because what we're hearing here is that, like, you know, you saw a picture of Blind Boy Full holding a resonator and then you found one in a junk shop and came, you know, brought it back on a brick lorry. And somehow between buying this really early tricone and getting looking inside and getting a sense of what the guys were thinking when they were building these things, right to now, you've been able to tell the family their own family's history, their family business. It's bizarre to think that we're going back to 1927, nearly 100 years, and you span the history and you're so connected to it in so many ways. You know, it's amazing to think, really.
What I find difficult is looking back over it, because a lot of time's gone by. I mean, I try and explain to people that it took me 6 years to write the book, but it took 30 something years to soak myself in it to a sufficient level where I thought I had enough information, enough bits of paper, enough photocopies, enough digital download photographs that I'd scrabbled around and copied from eBay just to build up this massive file of pictures and details. That's really what you need before you can even start the book. So it's like it's something I've been doing on and off since I was 18. An interesting point there, an interesting deviation from that is, that's the interesting way that you actually start writing this, because you've got to remember, I'm not an author. I haven't really got a clue what I was doing when I wrote this book. I just thought, well, how difficult can it be? I spend my life writing and putting together 4-page, 16-page brochures for companies, you know, glossy car brochures, that type of thing. How difficult can it be to make a book out of it? Surely it's the same thing stitched together, lots of different pieces. So I thought, so what actually happens, the logical process is, let's say you're looking at National New Yorker Lap Steels. The first thing you do is put your mind into that way of thinking, nothing else but lap steels. You trawl through every file that you've got. You find every picture that you can possibly get of lap steels, New Yorkers, and you lay them all out. And you start saying, right, now, why is that one different to that one? Why is this one? And then ultimately, it suddenly dawns on you that there are 14 different types of National. They all look like black and white National New Yorker lap steels, but they're all different. So then you've got to try and work out how to put them in order.
Yeah.
So you need extra information. So you need the catalogues, which is what I'm talking about. You need acres of national catalogues so that you can say, ah, that one is a 1935 one because it occurs in that catalogue, etc. So now you can put them in order. Okay. Then you have to be sure that you've got, have I got all of them in actual fact? So you need other information. So I tended to rely on things like Gröhn's vintage guitar book. Which is it's a pretty dry publication, really, because it's just words. And one of the things about guitars is they're not words, they're pictorial, you know. So to try and describe a guitar in words doesn't really give you much of a view of what it looks like unless you've got some really clever vision. But what it does do, it gives you lists and it documents what they have found of the actual thing. So I would then start, a bit like a train spotter, I'd start crossing them off. And then say, right, well, that one's that one. I've dealt with that one. That's the 1938, now the 1939. Is there anything in between? And slowly you just start organizing stuff until it's in a sequence that you can actually start saying, here's the beginning, here's the end of it. You know?
What you're saying is that one lap steel model, there's 14 variants. So to make sense of that one model, which is probably one or two pages in the book, that is... it could be a month of the work and research and ringing people and asking for photographs and looking for information just so you can then put it in sequence and tell people the story.
You're constantly cross-referring things in case you've made a mistake or I know now, for instance, bear in mind this is solely my work with, and I have to take the responsibility for any accuracy in it. I can't be 100% sure when I put down this is, and there are people out there who have opinions, and those opinions are just as valid as mine. There are people who are specialists in early electric guitars, for instance, which I wouldn't claim to be. And quite often I might be at a divergence with them where I think a lap steel might be the beginning of 1936 and they think it might be as early as August 35. But within a ballpark, you know,
yeah,
it's good enough for jazz, as they say, to start with, because we don't actually have the definitive thing. There aren't documents that will say this. Every once in a while, you see a really important instrument. In fact, one cropped up only the other week. There's an interesting one on eBay. A dobro turns up, Interestingly engraved, handmade. But what is the most important thing about it is when you take one of the screens out, inside it says handmade by Dr. Rudolf de Pira, October 1968. Well, I mean, that's pure gold, because you can't argue with it. If your facts don't look right and the instrument doesn't look right, that's your problem. You've got to work around it, because that's what it says. And I would trust Rudy's signature on it.
I think what I'm sort of hearing here is that all those kind of fans of, whether it's Hawaiian music or country blues and Delta blues, you know, the resonator guitar is inextricably linked with that kind of music. So for all of us that love that genre, that world, to be able to pick up a book which has all this information sequentially put in it, there's nobody else in the world that could have done this, because in order to show the variance, somebody needed to produce graphics, because there just aren't photographs of a high enough quality of everything that have been photographed in one place at the right time. So we needed a graphic designer, you know, who could play well enough to understand how the instruments work and how the instruments sound, which you have done. You've toured Europe, as you said, with some of the greatest players of these things. Also somebody who had a mindset that loves detail and facts and figures and can hunt the stuff down. I don't think there's anybody else in the world that could have done this and put all this together. And there's only you, by the sound of it, that has the entire skill set to do it.
I think it's a mindset more than a skill set.
Yeah.
I remember when I was working through the stuff in the book, obviously I didn't start it with a complete understanding of exactly what the end product would be. And I've said to you in the past, if I had have been confronted with a copy of my book before I started, I would have just run away screaming, because I couldn't possibly conceive. I look at it now and think, I can't possibly conceive I sat and drew 1,150 guitars like that. I mean, it's mental.
It's mental, that's the right, you said it. But I wasn't going to say it.
You know, but you see how it grows slowly and the sort of way you can put it together. There was also a time when it could have happened and a time before which it couldn't have happened. The digital world has allowed me to do it. I started originally thinking I'll do this because I was trained as an airbrush illustrator and various other things at college, and I was going to do it the manual way, which is Frisk film and inks and airbrush spraying, and I was going to build the guitars like that. And there are 5 or 6 original full color ones in existence. I think Mike's got a few and this, that and the other, and I've still got a couple here. But I realized that it was taking me the best part of 3 days to do a finished instrument. The house was completely covered in ink. I was virtually choking, because, you know. And if I'd have done all 1,100 instruments like that, my house would be just full of artboard and overlay sheets and, you know. And it was only because we got hard drives, digital storage, digital tablets to do it with that allows it to happen in a sane way. So that really literally dictated, you know, that the power of an iMac dictated whether I could do this or not, you know.
Can I ask a geeky question to try and I got to relate it to like geeky drum knowledge. This is where the people stop listening to the podcast. You're talking about that. So someone opened a 68 guitar and it has the maker's name on it. Do you record that? You're doing your best, I guess, but can you fundamentally say that was released in 68 or whatever, because that's the date on it. But then in drum terms, because they didn't sign it, sometimes they had dates in, but that was like the date that the shell was stamped, but that shell could have been on a shelf for 6 months and then the wrap gone on and the hardware different. And B2, Bill Ludwig was renowned for using up bits of hardware. So there's these anomalies that this shell came out in 60s, but it's got 50s hardware because he had it left, you know?
Let's put it this way. The one thing that we did learn a lot about with the National Company, the more numbers we get, is they're certainly not accurate in any way whatsoever. We have many occasions where there are no serial numbers, where the letter should be at the front, but it's at the back, where it's got extra letters that don't make any sense. We've got numbers that are on bodies that shouldn't actually have been made into the guitar that they are, but have been made something completely different. So they're carrying the wrong serial number from another model. So for instance, we could have a Don, which is a German silver high quality instrument that's actually sent out as a Style O with palm trees on it, which shouldn't happen. we have occasions where we have the same instrument standing in the, and Mark Schoenberger told me this one. He said, if I hadn't seen this with my own eyes and hadn't had both of them on my bench at the same time, I'd never have believed it possible. But I've got two Dons here and both of them are X16.
I don't know what that means.
Well, they both got the number X16 on the bottom, which means they're both, one of them's wrong. Let's put it that way.
Oh, they got the same serial number. How did you get around them in the book? How did you actually catalogue them?
Well, you have no choice but to sort of put it down and sort of say, well, this is what it is. It's up to you to work it out.
Right. Put it on the serial number list.
I have actually avoided some things in the book. There's my black museum of serial numbers that don't actually fit anywhere. And because there's only one or two of them, I can't make any sense of them any more than anybody else can. So I've just avoided them.
Yeah.
So you won't know about those. But there are. what was one of them? There's one of them has got something like C27FSXZ on it. And it makes no sense whatsoever. And it's the only one, so you just bury it. It makes no sense even trying to explain it. A good case in point would be, I think it's the D series. There is a Stylo, a Duolian, and a Style 3 Tricone, and a couple of other instruments. I think something like an early lap steel or something. Can't remember. Electric lap steel. So it's a late period. But there are only four or five in that D series, and every one of those instruments is completely incongruous and completely unrelated to the next one. So what can you possibly say about the D series?
But they've all got a D prefix.
Yeah.
Right. So that tells me that was maybe a sample batch or for a particular distributor.
What we sort of started to come to the conclusion of is there's with the Tricones, for instance, they have very late headstocks, but very early bodies. And they're almost like an amalgam of pieces that they had around that allowed them to complete an instrument relatively late on in the production line. So we're talking probably 1939-ish, something like that. And they will, for some reason, they've literally had to put a late piece on an early bit to get the thing out, to build it as a complete thing. And that might be the only constant thing, because the same thing's true of the Style O as is of the triplates. But it is assumption, a lot of this. You know,
yeah, of course. And there would have been a time where whatever the serial number was stamped and somebody manually changed the serial number stamper, that would have related to a ledger which had meaning.
Yeah.
And obviously the ledger's long gone. Was it you that told me there was a story that there was a secretary or somebody that did work at National that got in touch with somebody and said, oh, I used to work at National, I've got documents. And then nobody went and got them and they vanished. What was that something? Or have I made that up?
Don told me.
Don Young of National Resophonic.
Yeah, he was the CEO at National Resophonic, the owner basically at the time. Don told me that he remembers this woman. She lived in Bakersfield, I can remember that much, which of course is mid-California, central California town. And she had apparently been one of the secretaries or one of the assistants in the Chicago factory in the late 30s. And she is supposed to have had a lot of the documents that pertain to what models were issued, what numbers they were issued with, whether there were custom patterns and engravings, how they were done, who they were shipped to, who the first owners were, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, it's under the stairs, isn't it? So whatever happened to that, it's gone, we think. But
I mean, could you imagine that might have saved you 2 or 3 hours a day for 2 years, those documents.
Anything that would have been real and came from the company would have been of immense value, yeah.
It would. So, look, we've got a few things to sort of tidy up as we kind of move forward. So what I do know, you mentioned Don Young. So for people that are kind of following this, so we really are down the very thin end of the nerdiest resonator guitar information here. Don Young worked for the Dobro company that was owned by Gibson.
Worked for OMI and became
OMI. And working with some of the original brothers, and he was struggling to make instruments of the quality he wanted. So from what I understand, he then set up to start making his own Resonator Guitars, which is now the company we know as National Resophonic, not to be confused with the original National Company, as a lot of people do. So you knew Don Young and you advised him a lot. And I believe that when they started making tricones, like you were sort of part of that, and your friend Alan Timmins was part of that. So tell us about Don Young. Tell us about talking to Don Young, and tell us about how you helped him, and also how like the tricone came about.
Well, Alan Timmins mentioned, he was the guy who plated my first National, if you like.
Yeah.
He was an engineer, basically. He was as fascinated by these things as I was, but in a completely different way. I remember him coming around one day and he said, I think I can make one of those. This would be 1986, something like that. And I said, well, that looks a tall order to me. What do you think? And he said, well, looking at it, he said, it's all pretty much flat plate. There's no doming, or not like a domed cover plate on a single cone. It's all pretty much flat. He said, I think the most complicated bit making by hand is probably that T-bridge hand strap that goes over the T-bridge. He said, I'll tell you what, give me the cover plate off one of those. And he says, I'll see what I can do. Well, I don't think he'd been gone 24 hours before he'd come back with a perfect replica in brass of a hand rest for it. And he said, I think I'll give it a go and make one of these things, which he attempted to do. And this would be through 1987-ish. Now, this was the time we were initially talking with Bob Brosman for the first time. I was having these phone calls. I was trying to record just to remember everything he'd said. And we were playing, as we discussed earlier, with our National Gallery band. And I think it was Mike Cooper who decided that Bob Brosman ought to come and play in Britain. We needed to find out what this guy was about, you see. So setting up concerts and things for him would be a good opportunity to get him over. I think it was 87 when they celebrated, or the world celebrated, the 100th anniversary of slide guitar, which relates back to Joseph Kikuku and his initial attempts at playing in Hawaii. In order to celebrate that, this concert was set up called Sliding Round the World at the ICA in London, and we invited Bob to come and play at it. And that was the first time all the various Resonator family over here managed to sort of hook up with him and see what we would do. Well, Alan and I turned up there with a finished nickel-plated triplate, which we'd made, which completely sort of threw Bob for a loop, because he thought he was in control with his buddy Don Young of where the National Guitar was going in the future.
So did you meet him at Heathrow Airport with a brand new tricone?
His plane was late and it was all a last minute thing. In fact, he was almost ready to go on stage. He came straight in through the door, opening his case and got on the stage. So,
right, I see. So, okay.
Yeah, but you know, all this happened afterwards. But then he realised that these hick people in the UK weren't as out of the loop as he thought. So he then gets on the phone to Don and says, these guys in Britain are making these things. Little did he know that we were very much a cottage industry, but he went back and told Don, and Don then started to pull the whole tricone production thing forward. I don't think they expected to be making them under pressure from somebody else doing it, you see.
So because Alan was obviously a genius kind of engineer guy, he just reverse engineered his own tricone. Have you got it to hand or not? Because I know you've shown, you've got two that Alan made, haven't you? You've got the original metal one that you're talking about. Yeah. Have you got it?
Yeah.
So again, for YouTube, you'll see this. So what we're looking at now is a handmade tricone by Mark's friend Alan. Was it 87, you said?
87, this goes back to. Well, this predates even the next one to come out, even before NRP, were the Continental ones in Europe that were made out of Munich in southern Germany and Czechoslovakia, I think they were, weren't they?
Yeah.
But they were 89, so this is a year or so earlier than that.
So it's interesting. So you've got sort of three separate things here. You've got you and Alan, obviously very enthusiastic. You've got Don and Bob over in America, then you've got the guys at Continental in Germany and Czechoslovakia, all trying to reproduce these things. Because I guess at the time, there's a lot of interest. This is post-Mark Knopfler, post-Brothers in Arms. People are interested in shiny guitars, and you can only buy old ones, so people are trying to make new ones.
That's exactly what happened. The German ones came out of a chap who, I forget his name now, he ran a music shop in Munich. he had connections with people who were fascinated by them, who were engineers in Czechoslovakia, who went on to become the Amistar company. They were, at the time, they were having necks imported, I think, from Japan. So it was very much a sort of a tri-country construction there. But that, as I say, that evolved into the Amistar company. Alan and I were sort of getting interested. We had no real intention of making vast amounts of them, although Alan did go on to make probably a dozen, 15 instruments, something like that. I mean, he moved. I'll show you just one other thing, actually. But by the time Alan had finished, Alan sadly died many years ago now, but he did go on to move. He was never one to stay with the same thing for long. Once he discovered he could do it, he was off doing something else. And he decided he would make carbon fiber instruments. So the next thing he comes up with are these things.
Wow, look at that. So again, just to tell people on the podcast. So what we're looking at here is essentially what looks like a black tricone guitar, but all the metal work, like the grills and the cover plate, is metal. It looks really beautiful in black with all that, the silver plate.
This one is a little bit of a co-construction. It is actually the last instrument that Alan made before he died. It was actually in his workshop without a neck on. And my friend John Alderson, who's another great luthier, assembled the rest of it for me, just so that we could get it to a point where it became an instrument. Other than that, it would have probably just been a part and got thrown away, which I didn't really want to happen.
No. So it looks beautiful. So what are they like as instruments, those?
Well, they have a different sort of sound. Alan is a curiosity, as I say, because he would move very quickly, and he would do what he wanted to do, irrespective of whether he had the full amount of knowledge. So in other words, he'd just go for it and make things. So Alan made these carbon fiber instruments literally by making them in the same way you would use fiberglass sheet and use a resin and coat it all up and build them into molds and all the rest of it. He would do all that, but then he would finish it off with fiberglass inside. And it would stay quite rough. He wouldn't do it. Now, anybody will tell you, if they work in the carbon fiber industry, is high tech beyond belief. They make Formula One racing cars of this stuff. It's not a throwaway thing you do with a decorating brush on the bench, this stuff. It's a highly engineered, carefully temperature controlled, engineered thing. People who know about this look at Alan's, in the inside of Alan's, and say, well, it's a bit rough, isn't it? I said, yeah, but the rest of it's fine. I say, yeah, but Alan didn't worry about the inside. But the result of that is it has a great warm sound. Funnily enough, the ones that are made in subsequent years with carbon fiber, where they're absolutely precision engineered, have a bit of a sort of a harsh sound. And I always put it down to the fact that Alan, through serendipity, managed to get a wonderful sound out of it, not really knowing why, to be honest. So Alan made probably, I think, 6 or 7 of these instruments. Dave Peabody, a British blues singer, plays one. Mike Cooper has got one, which he's very fond of. He made some mandolins. He made some ukuleles, carbon fiber ones, metal ones. So all in all, probably 15, 20 instruments. Not enough to say it's he's one of the great luthiers, but enough to set the cat among the pigeons at a very early date as well, compared to other people.
This is what I was going to say. So I think we're, you know, we're getting towards the end now. And I think it's interesting that there's this time, it's the late 1980s, where these people are trying to set these, you know, people are trying to remanufacture these instruments. There's enough of an interest in a groundswell. So tell us about your relationship with Don Young and the early days of the National Resophonic Company, and how you and Don kind of helped each other. Because it sounds like you did. Don worked with the DePeers. Don knew about these things, so you seem to have a good friendship with him.
Yeah. We were all talking together. I mean, I was talking with Bob. I was talking with Don Young, et cetera, et cetera. And when Don realized what we were doing, of course, we were all in the loop then about who was doing what first, and send me pictures of what you make, and you show me yours, I'll show you mine.
Boing.
And there was a point at the beginning where Don's specialization in those early days was a single cone instrument. So yeah. as most people will know, the jazz blues and the Islander were the first two that they really put onto a production's level of things. They were talking about triplates. It was obviously the way to go, but I don't think they'd got really much intention of doing it that year. This would be 88, 89.
Yeah.
But when they did get around to doing it, I remember us having a conversation with him, and he said, well, we're a long way from doing it because we need to get the T-bridges cast, etc., which was proving a problem for them. And Alan said to him, I've already done that. I've made patterns for them and I've had them cast, etc. I can send you whatever you need initially. And Don said, well, that's a great idea because it means we can get some of the trichomes out sooner than we thought. So I think it was the first 21 triplanes that came out of NRP. I've got Alan Timmins T-bridges in them before Don finally got around to making his own relationship with a slush casting, you know, sandcast foundry, as it were.
That's cool.
Isn't that interesting? So, I mean, those very early days of National Resophonic, there's you and Alan and just this really small world helping each other out, which I find fascinating. So we're moving through to the 90s. Now, I know that when did you play your last gig? Was it about 96 was the last gig you played. Was it, what year was it? Was it 94 that George Harrison turned up at the house? Tell us that story.
Well, it's down to Alan again.
Oh, okay, good. Good old Alan, eh?
Alan decided, because Alan was just in his own little world with his fiberglass guitars and his triplate T-bridges and what have you, he rang up George Harrison, like you do. He just decided it was time to ring him up and sort of, I don't even know why. I think it was really just a bit of self-publicity, just to say, I don't know if you know, we make these things. He'd seen George Harrison with a ukulele. See, that's a resonator ukulele. And I think what surprised him was that when he rang up, he got straight through. When I come into the scheme of this, Alan's already made this arrangement for George to come and see him with some ukuleles that need repair. The next thing I hear about it is I get a phone call. This would be June of 94. From a guy called Alan Rogan, who actually turns out to be George Harrison's guitar technician, and says, is it okay if George and I come round? Well, I mean, when somebody says, is it okay if a Beatle comes round, you sort of start to get suspicious as to the truth of it, you know? Sure enough, an hour or so later, a black Porsche turns up outside, and out they get, just George and Alan Rogan.
Alan have his own ukulele guy?
No, apparently not. Of course, Alan was here, and he said, when we all got into this conversation, I looked at the back of the... He had four ukuleles with him. Two of them were a small body Triolian uke, which had been replated. The paint had been stripped off, and it had been plated, nickel-plated. He had a long body original style one ukulele in really nice condition, and he had two small Regal and Dobro ukes, the little wooden ones with the small Dobro cover plates on them. Okay, so he came in, he got out of the car, and he was carrying all four of them, two in each hand, without cases, just walked in and threw them on the sofa. Literally threw them on the sofa.
And this is the house that you're in now?
Yeah, he just literally threw them on the sofa. And I sort of looked at these things, and one of them, the small Triolian uke, had got on the back of it, if you turned it over, it looked as if somebody had got a centre punch, like you would use to, you know, bang into metal, and bang about 10 dents into the back of it. And I said, how did you do this? And he sort of went all sort of sheepish and apologetic and said, well, I had this party at Friar Park at his house, and he got a lot of his friends around there, and he started talking as if you didn't know who these people were. So he said, well, I have this friend called Jim Capaldi. You weren't supposed to know that he was the drummer of Traffic. That was just a friend of his. And I have another friend called Joe Brown. And he'd go through all these people who were around at the house, you see. And he said, I went to make a coffee and I could hear them playing in the other room. And he said, I thought Jim had got a nice drum sound. I went in there, he was banging hell out of the back of this ukulele with drumsticks, you see.
Bloody drums.
Yeah. And he'd taken Alan at his words and thought, well, I'll give Alan these instruments and he could do the repairs for me, you see. That's how he turned up and why he turned up, you know. Never expecting anything like that to happen. But he was very full of his George Formby, very full of his ukulele history. That was really what mattered to him when he came. But, you know, and we sat talking about you know, where would you get nationals and all the rest of it, and who to trust and who you don't trust and where you can get things.
That's cool.
How long did George spend at the house then?
Well, he turned up just after lunch and he was still there at seven. You know, one of those situations where you sort of, you're trying to say, we're going now, and you get as far as the hall and then off you go again. And then you get as far as the front door and you get as far as the garden gate, you know. We must have spent an hour by the garden gate, and he was, there were two or three people who would wander past and sort of look with that sort of, I know what I'm looking at, but I don't really believe it, because
people
turn up in the east suburbs of Nottingham, you know.
I mean, I remember you telling me once, you're in your guitar room and you were just like upstairs, and at one point did you say you were playing some Beatles songs with him or something?
Yeah, that's the one thing I'll just remember. I remember attempting a little bit of Taxman with him, and Here Comes the Sun. I mean, how cool is that? You know?
It's the coolest thing ever.
The one thing I remember, putting that a bit into context, he'd just come from the video studios where they were doing all the edits on that, you know, that mega series that came out called the Beatles Anthology. Mm. And I think it amounted to about 12 hours of video that was projected on the BBC. Big major epic. It was the Beatles talking about the Beatles. He'd just gone through all that editing, and I remember him saying to me, it's the first time he'd actually looked at all that old footage of getting on and off aircraft in Germany and Japan and things. And it felt like he was watching a story that involved somebody else. It didn't actually feel like him in it. He didn't immediately go, oh, I remember that. Oh, I this, that, and it felt like a story he was watching for the first time. And he did say to me, he said, George Harrison Beatle was a shirt I once wore. But wow. I thought it was quite telling. Yeah.
Did you have like a Beatles ticket on the wall or something? Or have I again ever made that?
Yeah, I don't even know if it was an original ticket, but I had a Shea Stadium ticket in a little frame on the wall, and he just wandered over to it and said, I was there, you know.
So the book came out in 2013, didn't it?
Yes.
And here we are in 2022, so that's like 9 years ago. So just tell us a little bit about finally getting the book done and how that works, because it's an amazing resource for people.
The advantage of doing it in print, of course, is that it's a real book and people can carry it around. It actually had more put in it than I really wanted to, but in conversation with quite a few people who helped me, particularly in the States and various places, I remember having a conversation about amplifiers, and I wasn't going to put amplifiers in it at all, because I was interested in what I was interested in. And I remember the conversation went along the lines of, if this is going to be the definitive book with the serial numbers, and you need everything in there, because if somebody's going to go to a trade fair to buy a vintage guitar, they don't want to be carrying 10 books. If you've got stuff to put it in it.
It's a very big and heavy book. And I think I said to you, like, when I first received my copy, I couldn't comprehend what I was looking at. It took me some time to get my head around what actually was in there. It was, does that kind of make sense? Because I've never seen a book with that scope.
I'm aware how long it takes just to idly flip through it. It's something like 2.5 to 3 hours, as if you're just turning pages over and just...
We had a conversation, didn't we, about maybe 7-8 months ago, and we were talking about something, and I didn't understand the sequence of Lap Steel. So I read your book like a storybook. So I had like at least followed the family tree through, and it was a couple of hours every evening for probably a week until I kind of finished it.
That's why I'm aware when I start looking at it with those eyes myself, I'm conscious of the fact that I can't believe I actually bloody did this.
It's incredible. It's an incredible work. And this is what I think is really nice to share with people, because there's a lot of, you know, resonator and blues enthusiasts around the world that might own this book, is to give them the backstory and what goes into making it, so they can maybe appreciate just what's gone into it. You self-published, and I know that you stumped your own money up. And we don't necessarily need to talk about figures and stuff. Are you in debt with this book? Are you in profit with this book?
I'm actually, as at the beginning of this year, we're actually in profit.
So for 9 years of selling these books yourself, you've been in debt so that people could have this information personally.
The other thing that it comes down to, of course, is, as you know, my backstory being a graphic designer, I actually work with an infrastructure of printers and various people. So I know these people. And it was really a coming together of friends of mine who had printing companies who said, look, I'll sort this out. We'll get this going. We'll do this. Something. A lot of which would have been much more problematic if I was just walking in and saying, print this, please. I'll pick them up on Tuesday, you know.
Well, I'm sensing a lot of altruism on your part. Like, obviously, a lot of occupying yourself and getting information, because that obviously is important. But the fact that you then did eventually find the confidence and get the help to like finish it and share it and then stump the money up, I think there's just underlying that there's somebody that just wants to share the information and make the world a better place for people that are into this. And
I needed the story to be out there. Going full circle, I don't think I ever got over the fact that I was told absolutely nothing by Chris Hayes at the Melody Maker back then. These things can't be just this. Is that it? You're just going to dismiss them like that, you know?
Yeah, if Chris Hayes would have come back with, like, you know, like a few paragraphs, John DePere and these guys, 1927, you'd have been like, that hole is filled, and the rest of your life you'd just been playing some music and being fine with it. But no.
So I just wanted to ask one more thing about, are there any guitars you've had in your collection, you know, the one that got away, or a couple of really significant ones that you still have or that have gone now?
Interestingly, what you've hit on there, Jack, is I have changed over the years, because I don't go on eBay places with an intention of actually fighting somebody for the stylo that's turned up. It doesn't interest me anymore. I've sort of done that over the years. But what does interest me are the things that you don't see, you don't get the opportunity to have, the rare stuff that turns up you weren't expecting, those sort of things. I mean, there's a couple here, for instance. Most people will know this is a Style 97. This is the...
Has that got colour on it?
Yeah, it's sort of blue and white and orange. I don't know what you can see there on it.
People will have to look on YouTube or whatever if they want to see
it. It's basically a tenor guitar, you know.
Okay, interesting.
Four strings.
Yeah. What's intriguing about it, though, is that in 20-something years, and I think Bob Brosman found one of these in 1989, something or other, and located it in his book in the numbers. This is the same instrument. This is it. We've never found another one.
Is there only one?
Yeah, for all the, well, I'm not saying there is only one, but apparently there's only one. Nobody else.
Up to now, there's only one. So,
unless, as they always say on these things when you're talking to the world, unless you know different, you know, I don't know. So you find these sort of things are intriguing. You can't really value them. You don't really know what to suggest. There is the famous guitar. They're rare in themselves. The mandolin is even rarer. This thing, this is it. This is the only one.
Holy grail, is it?
So, well, is it a holy grail? I mean...
Well, is it your holy grail?
Yeah, it's interesting. Let's put it that way. You only find, you know, when somebody's got a massive interest in something and the whole world wants one and there's only one, then it's valuable. But if you've got the only one and nobody really knows it exists, it's a different thing. And then there are these things. I mean, this one, this thing is a National Estrelita. There is an NRP model out now called an Estrelita. Well, if anybody's unsure what the original Estrelita was, it's this thing from 1934. I got this thing as a complete basket case. It was a bag of bits, basically. Broken, dirty, covered in grease. And what I did know about it was how rare it was in terms of its place in the national scheme of things. It looks like most people would regard this as a national Trojan, which is the standard wood body that most people have probably seen. But this one is a bigger body. It's a much deeper body, auditorium orchestra size. And so far, I think we've found about 14 of them that exist worldwide in total. So I wasn't about to let this one go, just the fact that even if it was a basket case. And my good friend Mike Lewis in Paris, I sort of threw this at him saying, I don't know if you can do anything with this, but can we rebuild it? And what he did with this is just spectacular.
It looks as good as new from what I can see here on the Zoom call.
Absolutely brand new. And I can't describe how bad the neck had been worn out sideways, not just worn across the fretboard. The side was
now. That probably means it was a good instrument, does it? Because someone really played it.
Crashed it to death for years and years, and their hands were like sandpaper. and they literally worn the entire instrument out. Well, Mike went that extra, you know, 9 yards to put pieces down the side. The whole thing was reshaped. He's just done the most spectacular piece of lutery I've ever seen, to be honest.
Amazing.
And so I'm fascinated and I have to say intrigued by the possibility of what you can save. I mean, I know it's probably not original in most people's eyes, but when you've got something that it's either a question of throwing it in the bin or turning it into this, I know what I'd rather do with it. Mm-hmm. You know?
It's a beautiful restoration job on that, in that case.
It is.
And if it's one of 14, then you've preserved history there.
Yeah, I mean, I have said to people, some people have said, was it worth restoring something like an old Trojan? Was it worth going to that level with it? And I've said, if it was an old Trojan, I'd probably take it to the bin with you, because the world doesn't need Trojans. There are thousands.
Hey, I like mine.
Well, you know what I mean? But there are thousands of them. It's not as if it won't be the end of the world if you lose your Trojan, because there's another one out there.
Have we got any more show and tell? Because this is really interesting, well, even for me.
The only other one I was going to say was the one that subsequently, once I realised what Mike would do with that, we found this fella.
Oh, right. For people on the podcast, what you can't see is that Mark has just picked up a resonator guitar that is about as big as he is. It's a massive instrument. What's that?
Well, this is a National Aragon. Again, they're normally too expensive to consider buying. This, again, was almost a basket case. And I thought, well, it might be worth grabbing it. Again, it doesn't, I mean, it looks, again, brand new, but it doesn't look totally original in that sense. Although I have to say, even though this was damaged and looked a real mess when it was acquired, the damage was totally cosmetic. It had been kept in a sort of desert area for most of its life. And all that had happened was the thing had desiccated. The paint had just flaked. Everything was, I mean, normally if you'd kept a guitar like that in Britain, so much damp would have got into it. The thing would have distorted, it would have delaminated and everything, and it wouldn't have been worth messing with. But this was in perfect condition. It's just that its paint had just dried and flaked off it, basically. So this was little more than a paint restoration, more than anything else. But again, yeah. it was Mike Lewis, this, who just has a skill beyond comprehension when you see these things.
I think it's widely regarded that Mike Lewis, him and, yeah, you know, Mark Schoenberger are really the top of the heap in terms of world resonator work.
You need that back experience that goes back over many decades.
Yeah.
There's no substitution for it. You can't just take a good, even if you've got a good luthier, you can't take a guitar from a completely different understanding, and the way the things are put together is completely different to a standard flat top acoustic. So even if I knew a good luthier, I wouldn't go to them.
Yeah, I was going to say, resonators really should be handled by people that understand resonators. So obviously, those two people we mentioned are very important. But obviously, Steve Evans and Dave King are others, you know, of course, and John Alderson, as you mentioned. And, you know, they are really the people that understand these things. So there we go, then. We've got to the end there. Thank you so much for your time and sharing that.
You're very welcome. What else can I say?
I think this has been a very guitar geeky heavy one, isn't it? But I think it'll be good for all the people who've read your book, Mark, and all the people on these forums that I know exist. I think it'd be good to get a bit of backstory to all that. So I'll get a geeky drum dealer on soon, and we'll pay you back, Martin.
Yeah, we'll even it up. Yeah, this is definitely a guitar heavy, but I think I think the resonator guitar is a very iconic part of guitar history. And they are beautiful instruments. And Mark really is the man who's told the story best, and is the guy. And I think to actually get the backstory to how that came about is really interesting. I find it fascinating, and I hope other people do.
Yeah,
they don't just fall off another planet, these books, do they? They do.
They don't.
There you go then. Well, thanks so much then, Mark. Yeah, we'll catch you again at some point, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there we go. That was Mark Makin. Jack, that was a lot of resonator information. Did that make any sense to you? What did you make of all that?
It was a bit over my head, a lot of that, to be honest. I think this will be very useful for people who are interested in resonators and guitars in general. It's a very guitar heavy, this one. But I really enjoyed just him as a person, and that how studious he was in cataloguing that. I don't know, I just haven't met a lot of people like that, really. I don't think there are a lot of people like that. So as you kind of summed up in the episode, I think it's like he was very fitting to do it.
He's a bit of a sort of Renaissance man and a bit of a sort of savant almost. And I think there's so many other parts of his life that we didn't go into, in which he's also an expert in. So
I think.
And you know, he, one things we didn't really talk about, he talked about playing a bit and playing with people. He is regarded by the great sort of blues players as being one of the great blues players, and you'd never know it talking to him. It took me, you know, months of knowing him and speaking to him on the phone about Resonator history before that even cropped up as a conversation that he did do some playing. And it's, I think that's really telling of him as a person. So I hope, you know, we got to share some interesting stuff there for you know, people that are interested in Resonator guitars, you know, and how we now know the history and things. On that subject, I mean, I've held up the book a few times on this podcast and stuff. So if people want to get a copy of it, they can go to the Mark Making website, just Google Mark Making, and you can buy a copy and get it sent around the world wherever you are.
M-A-K-I-N, yeah? Mark with
that's
a K
it.
And M-A-K-I-N.
That's right, Mark Making. And it's... the book is called Palm Tree, Senoritas and Rocket Ships. And it's a big book. It's a substantial book. It's quite an expensive book. But what I'd say is, you know, it is worth every penny. You have to see it to believe it. And there's many hours of interest and information, because you get, you know, you get all the, every catalogue that's ever produced and every page of it is in there somewhere. There's like little bios about all the great kind of players. So it's not just a sequential sense of guitars. It is a whole history of the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s, 70s, 80s. You know, it really
however much that cost. That was like 30 odd years of his life gone into doing that. I think it's going to be worth it.
It's a good point. And I think one of the things that podcast, I hope people get from that, is that this guy just loves the information and produced this at his own cost, not ever wanting to make a profit from it. Because he wants to share it, and he stumped up his own money to do that. And do you know what? Like, it's worth it. The value for money is that you get this amazing resource that you can just keep going back to for different reasons. You know, you might see a guitar online for sale, and then you can check the age and the time of it through the serial number list. And then 6 months later, you could be reading about Sunhouse or, you know, Ed Genny, so whoever it is that you want to read about, there's information about players in there, or you might want to look at a particular catalogue one day and see what it was like at a particular year. It's all in there, and that guy shared it out of the goodness of his heart. So anyway, it sounds like an advert now. It wasn't meant to be that.
Yeah, that's it. We'll take a commission on that, I reckon.
There's no commission. It's I'm just glad to share it, because I just think, obviously, he wants to share the information and people should get that. So it's a very long way of saying go and buy his book.
Yeah, there we go. Well, thanks for that. Thanks for bringing him in, Martin. That was nice to meet him. And
he's somebody I think I admire about as much as it's possible to admire anybody. I really do. And I'm really glad to share that.
Right. Well, I'll speak to you next week for next week's guest.
Yes, man. I look forward to it.
Thanks for listening to the Washboard Resonators Present.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate and leave a comment.
And to support our band, please sign up to the mailing list. You'll find the link in the show notes and on the website.